Good morning, church. Today is the sixth and final sermon in our sermon series through Lamentations, Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy. And we've noted throughout this sermon series that the vast majority of Christian worship songs are more celebratory than they are full of lament. But there are a few lamenting songs out there, and perhaps the most well-known song would be It Is Well With My Soul. For those who don't know the story, the author of the lyrics, Horatio Spafford, had been through some stuff that would certainly lead to lament. He had had a son die. He had lost a lot of his finances, his family's finances, through the Great Chicago Fire in the 1870s. His family was really devout, and they had committed to going on an evangelistic campaign in England. So his wife and four daughters got on a ship. He stayed back, planning to meet them there. The ship crashes. His wife survives. All four daughters did not. And out of that came the lyrics we know to be It Is Well With My Soul. So a person who knew lament. And the chorus concludes with, it is well with my soul. He's really trying to declare that to be true. The song doesn't end this way. I'll end it slightly differently. It is well with my soul. Right? Songs don't normally end with that kind of minor feel to it, that kind of unresolved note just hanging in the air. Even a song of lament like It Is Well With My Soul. But we want resolution. We crave it, especially as Westerners, as Americans. I remember watching a really bad movie. Don't recommend it. The Breakup. Anybody seen The Breakup? Do you agree? Okay. And there's a movie with Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston, and it's all about their breakup. But you assume that by the end, the breakups, you're going to change their minds. They're going to figure it out. They're going to resolve. But they don't. They're in Grant Park in Chicago. They walk their separate directions. Roll credits. Unresolved. Probably why I didn't enjoy it, why I didn't like the movie, is there was zero resolution to it. Most movies do lead to resolution. Even a movie as tragic as the Titanic, right? Titanic, which is another tale of many people dying in the Atlantic Ocean, doesn't end with Jack descending into the water. Spoiler alert, apologies if you didn't know that. It ends with 90-some-year-old Rose reflecting idyllically back with nostalgia about all the great moments in that tragedy. Now, in non-Western cultures, it's not always as often this way in stories. A few years ago, I read a book called Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And my friend Jonathan Thomas had read it before me and had recommended the book. But he did say, he had a caution, he said, Aaron, the ending is a bit West African in its style. I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, there's not really a neat and tidy conclusion. I'm curious to see what you think. And I find that Jeremiah, the writer of Lamentations, is a bit more like that novel Americana than the song It Is Well With My Soul. He leaves us without a neat and tidy resolution. So if you came expecting that today, if you were hoping that we're going to wrap this up with a nice bow, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed. It is Palm Sunday. The Royal City Kids might help us a little later, but for now we're going to sit in this minor feeling of unresolution. So today our main idea is that we need to be real about where we do have unresolved lament and be real about that with God and invite others into it as well. Let's go ahead and stand for the reading of Lamentations 5. Today, I will read it over us. You don't need to feel like you need to read along. I'll emphasize different things here and there that might not be natural for 140 or 150 of us to read at the same time. Remember, Lord, what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. We've become fatherless, our mothers are widows. We must buy the water we drink. Our wood can be had only at a price. Those who pursue us are at our heels. We are weary and find no rest. We submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. Our ancestors sinned and are no more, and we bear their punishment. Slaves rule over us, and there's no one to free us from their hands. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the desert. Our skin is hot as an oven, feverish from hunger. And then he goes on to list many different people in society. Women have been violated in Zion, and virgins in the towns of Judah. Princes have been hung up by their hands. Elders are shown no respect. Young men toil at the millstones. Boys stagger under loads of wood. The elders are gone from the city gate. The young men have stopped their music. Joy is gone from our hearts. Our dancing has turned to mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our hearts are faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim. From Mount Zion, which lies desolate with jackals prowling over it, you, Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures from generation to generation. Why do you always forsake us? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to yourself, Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. And that's where he ends it, right there, with a minor note. This is still the word of the Lord. And the people said, thanks be to God. Let these words fill our minds, flow from our mouths, and free our hearts to live as the beloved children of God. You may be seated. We've all heard the idiom, time heals all wounds. What a bunch of crap. Right? What a bunch of crap. What did Siri think about that? She didn't like it either. Even Siri didn't like it. Because there's so many wounds where time doesn't heal. There are some physical wounds, like a paralysis or losing sight in one's eyes. There are things that just end. It could be the bankruptcy of a business. It could be the shuttering of a school. Could be a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, a painful divorce, the death of a child, the suicide of a dear friend. In high school, I had three really close friends, a friend named Dave, a friend named Jeff, and a friend named Greg, and we were together all the time. We were at each other's houses, we were in the same classes, we were playing sports together, we were around each other often. But senior year, Greg started to make some choices that were a little different than the ones we had traditionally made. He started drinking more, and despite that, he still achieved a golf scholarship and an academic scholarship on a full ride to Ohio University. But his choices continued, and soon enough, between the sophomore and junior year of college, Greg went missing. And at the time, in 1999, there were no cell phones, so there was no way to really track where he had gone. And eventually, he used his parents' credit card to make a purchase in Arizona, and then he made a purchase in Kansas City. So it seemed like Greg was returning home. That summer, I was working at a camp up in Michigan, right here, for the Michiganders in Everett. And on the last day of the week of camp on Friday, it was about 11:30 or so, I got a tap on the shoulder. You have a phone call. So I went to where there was a corded phone, hopped on the phone, and it was my mom letting me know that Greg had taken his own life. And I remember what I felt with that phone up to my ear. I remember what I felt as I tried to find my way back to my campers. I remember the 5 hours of driving back to Columbus and what it was like to interact with my friends in those first moments. I remember what it was like to carry his casket, to interact with his parents in the days to come. I remember trying to go back to camp the next week. I remember looking up at the stars and just trying to make sense of it all. I remember the dreams I had literally for years. They only recently stopped. They probably are going to come back since I'm talking about it. Where I would interact with Greg, and they were so vivid. My dreams were so real. He was real. It had all been a mirage. Time was not the thing that healed those wounds. It was work. It was pleading with God. It was entering into it with others. It was going on that journey together. It wasn't and hasn't been just the 24 years that have elapsed. And there's still not resolution. There's still triggers. The word suicide. Golf. These different things that, Alum Creek, there's reasons why these things are triggers for me all these years later. And we all have different types of lament that persist, that linger, that remain unresolved. And what about for you? Are there wounds where time has not healed those wounds that persist, a job loss, a time of deep depression, a relationship that deteriorated and fell apart? This past week was spring break for Westerville City Schools, which is where we live, and our family took a city trip. We went to New York City, the Big Apple. It was a blast. Our kids are 13, 11, and 10, and they're at that point where they can hop on the subway and they can, you know, do the museums and all the stuff. So we decided, especially after they had explored the history of September 11th at school, and we had talked about it at home, to go and visit the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in Lower Manhattan. Has anybody been to that museum? A few hands, okay. Anybody been to the memorial on the surface, on the street level? A few more hands. So on the street level, for those that have not been, there are two large square pools that go down into holes, right in the footprint of where the two towers stood. And it's powerful. It's a memorial to what used to stand there and what that place represents. But the museum, you get on an escalator and you descend, because the trade centers were built down onto 70 feet of foundation. That's how far down they went into the bedrock. And so the museum is built into the foundation in and around where the two towers were. Between the two imprints of the towers down underground is this image that will pop up onto the screen, or this wall, I should say, of these small square watercolors, different interpretations of the color of the sky that Tuesday morning. There are about 3,000 of these watercolors on the wall representing each of the lives lost on that day. And as I navigated with our family the museum, you kept interacting with individuals who worked there. And I thought to myself, we're in here for about 75, 90 minutes. These individuals who work here, the docents and the guides, every workday they descend that escalator and they're exposed day in and day out to this lament. This one person, as we entered into one exhibit, she said, "You are entering a sacred space. Please, no photographs." A few 30 seconds, 60 seconds later, You're entering a sacred space, please no photographs. That repetition, that exposure day in and day out. And so I wondered, in a place of perpetual lament, how do you feel as somebody who works there? Do you become perpetually numb to it? Do you remain angry and bitter? Do you enter into even a state of depression? Is it some combination of all of those? But I would also imagine you're in this state of perpetual remembrance. That phrase that's been connected with 9/11 of never forget has been a slogan ever since that day. And I think that's what Jeremiah is leading with in this passage today, this idea of remembrance, to never forget. He says in verse 20, "Why, God, do you always forget us? Why do you forsake us so long?" So if you fast forward to the very beginning of what I read, in verse 1, his plea is, "Remember, Lord, remember what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace. God, I don't want you to be perpetually numb to my lament. I don't want you to be perpetually angry or bitter or depressed. But I do want you to remember it. I want you to be in it with me." And not just the concept of philosophy. Jeremiah does not just lay out some philosophies in this text. He gets specific. He gets very specific with what was causing the lament of he and the people and how it felt. There are several feelings that I sense as I read this passage again and again in preparation for today. Number one, this feeling of shame. See our disgrace. You know, when lament can possibly be a result of a financial crisis in your home, or someone in the family has made a certain decision that you feel has brought shame onto you and to others. That can be a feeling with our lament. Exhaustion. He says, we are weary and we find no rest. There have been many times, but particularly in the summer of 2020, whereas I interacted with Black brothers and sisters and said, how are you doing? How are you feeling? The answer was, I'm exhausted. To have these conversations and to watch these headlines and to participate in these protests, and I am exhausted. I'm exhausted in a quest for racial justice. Lament can lead to exhaustion. Lament can lead to deep sadness. Jeremiah says, joy is gone from our hearts. Our dancing has turned to mourning. We're in the midst of your lament. It's just, you can't find it. You can't find that joy you once had. You don't smile as much. Why aren't you happy? There's just a deep, deep sadness. I also sense that he's feeling this loss of status. He talks a lot, and we'll look at it a little bit later, about this loss of status that he's lamenting over. He says, the crown has fallen from our head. I think job loss can be an example of this, where there's a particular status that came with a position, maybe even a position of power, that one no longer has. A status change can be a feeling amidst lament. He talks about our hearts being faint, this idea of our heart representing our soul, and that our soul is dimming in the midst of our lament. Like, what's going on inside of me? I'm faint, not just externally, but internally as well. And then lastly, a lack of vision. Things are so dark. The clouds are so dark. I cannot see a way out of this. He's acknowledging all of these things, and I think it's something that is an encouragement for us and should have been, I hope, throughout the entire Book of Lamentations. Whether individual loss, collective loss, God wants us to be descriptive. He wants us to be descriptive in our pleas and our prayers with him. I know for me, as I wrestled with this week, I thought to myself, Aaron, when are your prayers simply things like, God, help us get through this tough time? You know, God, can you be with us? Can you be near? And I stay at the surface. When are we praying prayers like, Lord, I am utterly exhausted. God, I have no idea how I'm going to get out of the home today. I don't know how to deal with this. God, I've never felt this bleak about an outcome of something before. My soul aches, God. It aches. God, see me, see us, remember me, remember us. Be in our pain, God. Do I pray those kind of prayers? Do we pray those kind of prayers? Or are we staying at the God, can be with us, help us? This is a tough time, God. Do we stay there? So I'm going to pause here for a bit of a mid-sermon contemplative moment and ask you to seek a little bit, to say, what might be a persisting lament? And if you go a bit below the surface, how are you feeling about it? Maybe some of those six feelings that we had up on the screen that Jeremiah identified. What is a persisting lament for you? And how are you feeling about it? We'll give about a minute with that. Quiet moments can be so important. Even in all the preparation for this morning, as I just took 60 seconds, I had something come to mind that I hadn't thought about all week long that is there. That's some unresolved lament in a particular relationship. Now, I mentioned the status change part of how Jeremiah was feeling, and I don't think a conversation about Lamentations chapter 5 is complete without exploring more of what he was feeling about that status change and what he was asking God for at the end of the chapter. So let's check this out a little bit. So the people of Israel, over time, had various levels of status. So generations past knew slavery. They knew that kind of hardship in Egypt. They knew what it was like to be desert wanderers. But fast forward, the generations of the people of Israel also knew what it was like to be conquerors, to expel people from their land, to be slaveholders, not to be slaves themselves, to be prosperous. And now the tables had turned again. So in Lamentations chapter 5 and verse 2, Jeremiah says, our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. 8 through 10, he says, slaves rule over us, and there's no one to free us from their hands. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the desert. Our skin is hot as an oven, presumably because they're out working in the sun. We're feverish from hunger. In 16, he says, the crown has fallen from our head. Tables have turned. So then you get to verse 21, and we'll put this one up on the screen. It says, restore us to yourself, Lord. that we may return. Renew our days as of old. So my big question as I wrestled with this is, what is Jeremiah really asking for? He's got these three R's. He talks about restore, return, and renew. What is he asking for? And the more I really got a sense for what is he saying before, and then how does it lead up to this, if I'm honest, what it seems like he's asking is, God, make Jerusalem great again. Make Jerusalem great again. Restore us to that idyllic past. Bring us prosperity. Slaves ruling over us? What? Have we done that? Bring us back, our servants, to do our bidding. Expel the foreigner. Bring the crown back to our heads. Make Jerusalem great again. I think it's important to remember that the prophets are not perfect people. And so this part of Lamentations is not like we need to mimic Jeremiah, right? Because how God answers Jeremiah's prayer to restore, return, and renew is very, very, very different than what Jeremiah had in mind. One of the other texts that we've read, in addition to Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy, as the preaching team for this sermon series, has been the book Prophetic Lament by Sung Chan Ra. And a fantastic, fantastic book. I would highly recommend it. And in chapter 14, he starts to wrap up, and he titles the chapter Ending in a Minor Key. And he has so many insightful things. I couldn't just like hand out the book or put the whole chapter 14 up on the screen, but I tried to grab some of his insights that to me were most powerful. And so let's go ahead and check out what he has to say. He says, the narrative remains unresolved. A quick and easy solution is not offered. Hope is deferred, but it is not absent. The closing of the book on a minor note opens the possibility of a resolution coming at a later point in history. Freedom is coming for God's people. This freedom, however, is not simply the restoration of Jerusalem and a return to the promised land. The good news of the reign of God does not begin with a triumphant military victory by an exceptional hero. But instead, the good news of the reign of God is connected to a have-not. The unusual answer comes in the person of Jesus, who resolves the narrative of Lamentations. Amen. The story of Lamentations is completed in the incarnate Jesus, who comes to dwell among human flesh in the body of the city. The unresolved story is completed in the incarnate Jesus. So as you took a minute earlier and as you've reflected throughout, where are you with some of your persisting lament? How are you feeling? And thinking back to the 9/11 Museum and the docents and guides who work there every workday, where have you perhaps become perpetually numb? Or perpetually angry, or perpetually bitter, or depressed, longing for that return to the past. If it could only be like it was, I'd feel so much better. Or where have you perhaps sugarcoated things and prematurely declared, I'm good. One of our kids, it's his most favorite phrase right now, I'm good. When have you applied that to the state of some unresolved lament, where you've perhaps buried things and too rashly just tried to move on? Where have you remained at the street level at that memorial pool level and need to descend the escalator, maybe down 10, 20, 50, 70 feet even. And where that journey might take time, it might cause more lament, but it's needed to hop on. And perhaps you need to bring someone along with you or ask somebody, can you join me in this descent so that I can really be in the lament that I haven't seen resolution from? A friend, a family member might need to join you on that journey, or perhaps even a professional therapist that you need to invite to go down with you. Lamentations does not end the way "It Is Well With My Soul" ends. And "It Is Well With My Soul," I love that song. I don't want to dog it. I'm not dogging it. There are times where we need to end with, "The trump shall resound, and the Lord shall descend." Sometimes we need to declare that. And that's not, though, where Jeremiah is concluding Lamentations. Sometimes we need to end in a different spot. We need to end with just imploring God to remember us in our lament, to join us in what might be shame or exhaustion, in deep sadness, in a status change, in a dimming soul, in our lack of vision. God, join us in that. I'm not ready to declare about the trump right now, resounding, and the Lord descending. I'm not there. So a song that we were going to actually close this sermon series with is a different type of lament. "Precious Lord, Take My Hand." And this song was also written after a personal death, written by Thomas Andrew Dorsey. Both his wife and his infant son died. And the song of lament was eventually really used and became one of the favorite songs of a modern-day prophet, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This was a beloved song of his. It's actually one of the things he said right before he was assassinated about the service that night, was to play that song, "Precious Lord, Take My Hand," and play it real pretty, is what he said. It was a song sung at his funeral. And one of the reasons why it was such a favorite of Martin Luther King Jr.'s is because it was a way to plead with God for the welfare and the status of a people group, similar to what Jeremiah was pleading for. And it's a lament that doesn't quite yet declare, "It is well with my soul." It acknowledges exhaustion. It acknowledges a soul that's dimming even. But it's a song of lament that trusts that the God of the universe is also a God that is near and that takes our hands, that enters in to our lament. "Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on, let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on through the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home. When my way grows dreary, precious Lord, lead me near. When my life is almost gone, at the river I will stand. Guide my feet, hold my hand. Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home." So we're going to linger a bit in that lament. We're going to linger in that lament by having it sung over us. And as it's sung over us, just lean in. Ask God, "God, remember me, remember us in our lament."